Football Weekly Extra.
Much, much better than Monday's rival production, Ordinary Football Weekly. It is Football Weekly Extra. And here's what's on today's lineup. Carling Cup semis. Tottenham parade Jermaine Defoe, their new spur of the moment. And Derby beat Manchester United with a Commons motion. We ask, will one of the worst teams in the Championship now make it into Europe? And what plans are they making for Nigel? There's the week's other big transfer news, the latest from the Liga, including the ref who gave out 19 red cards in a single match. Joey Barton wasn't even playing in it. In Italy, we ask, you cannot be Serie A, as Beckham books himself a place in Sunday's big Roma-Milan matchup, and the Rossoneri go hunting Jermaine Pennant. There's Post and the Premier League weekend. Like Robbie Keane trying on Aaron Lennon's shorts, it's tied at the bottom, with 5 points separating the lower 10 clubs. There are 3 6-pointers on the way in the next few days. We preview the whole shebang on today's Football Weekly Extra. Hello, happy listener. On board today, Barry Glendenning.
Hi, James.
Hi, Barry. John Ashton.
Hello again, James.
Greetings, John. And Amy Lawrence. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, James.
Yeah, thanks. Producer Pete, standing by at the controls. Now, Carling Cup semi-finals took place Tuesday, Wednesday night. The big story, Derby, one of the worst teams in the Championship, who only just scraped by non-league Forest Green only a couple of days before battering Man United. The 1-0 scoreline belying their dominance of this fixture. Barry, you witnessed some of this.
I did. I witnessed most of it. Derby were by far and away the better team. Should have won. I mean, they played an understrength Manchester United team, but it was still a good Manchester United team, or it should have been good.
Yep. Tevez, Scholes, Vidic, Anderson, they were all in.
Yeah, some of the Manchester United performances were appalling, and their manager was fuming after the game. I don't think I've ever seen him that angry after a game. So,
How angry was he?
Well, he was so angry he was almost calm. But he didn't try to blame the referee. He offered no excuses whatsoever. He just said his players were terrible. He said that they were losing 1-0 was a fantastic result because they could have lost by 4 or 5, and that's correct. And I really would not have liked to have been a Manchester United player going, having to face him in the dressing room afterwards, because I'd say he ripped some of them a new one.
Ooh. He was majestically sarcastic, actually.
Yeah.
In his television interview, it was brilliant to behold. Actually, it was quite a performance.
He genuinely cares about this.
He does, and I think that's brilliant, mm-hmm. to be quite honest, because the Carling Cup obviously is not the highest priority for Manchester United, and the team selected reflects that. But he cares so deeply, even after all these years, about any kind of defeat. And he knows that there's an embarrassment associated with losing to a lower league opponent at any level when you're Manchester United. And I like the fact that he cared so much.
Rooney and Ronaldo came on quite early in the second half, I think after an hour. And that you could sort of sense that's a victory in itself for Derby County, because I would imagine he didn't want to send them on, but he had to in the end. Derby thoroughly deserved their victory, and they'll probably be disappointed they didn't win by more, because they may reap the whirlwind at Old Trafford in the second leg.
In a sense, they were without a manager, no? Because they had Chris Hutchings as a caretaker manager for the Forest Green narrow victory. And then David Lowe, who's he?
Well, David Lowe is the one of the academy coaches, and apparently he was coaching the under-8 side the day before, which is a pretty incredible leap to take, to then be taking on Man United in front of the cameras and in front of a packed Pride Park. Incidentally, as a sideline, I found it amazing to see a few people of the Derby fans leaving early when they're having one of their most memorable results in history. I know it's quite tricky getting away from Pride Park, and there is one road that gets very, very jammed up, but still. But it was nice to see the people of Derby relishing this kind of result, and it reminds you what a big club they actually are. And
a big club that has just conceded 3 goals to non-league Forest Green.
Yeah, but historically, Derby County are a major club in British football. And I think if you're their supporters, or indeed if you're Paul Jewell, you'd probably look at a performance like against Manchester United and wonder what they've all been doing in the last few months.
Well, of course, Paul Jewell no longer the manager. John, you're our Championship boffin. So you'll have, no doubt, your opinion on his tenure in charge and what perhaps the future holds from Nigel Clough, who will be in charge when they do visit Old Trafford, with this, you know, possibility of being a team from the lower end of the Championship getting into Europe in the UEFA Cup.
If they score at Old Trafford, United will have to score three, by my reckoning, to go through on with the away goals counting double. So, yeah, it would be, what a start that would be for Cloughy, Cloughy Jr., and it's a very interesting appointment, actually. I think a lot of Forest fans are slightly perturbed that they didn't go for Nigel and they went instead for Billy Davies, obviously with the Clough connection at that club as well.
Just in case there's someone out there who, you know, doesn't... Nigel Clough, son of Brian Clough, regarded generally as probably the most brilliant manager English football's ever produced.
Certainly up there with the top two or three, I think, yeah. Mm. And Nigel, his son, went the sort of... in a way, I suppose, the old-fashioned route, sort of the Paul Ince route of getting into management, went to a smaller club, Burton Albion, and he's been there for 10 years. Had a modicum of success. He's not really set the world on fire. Very highly respected in the larger Midlands area.
He's got one promotion, and he's got them in line.
He's got them to the top of the conference this year by a distance.
Spent a lot of money?
I don't think so. There's just no money to spend down there. I mean, it's all relative, I suppose. I can't claim to know if they've spent more or less. Then they're sort of rivals at that level.
But he's obviously got a great surname, but is there much in his track record that suggests he's going to be able to work wonders at Derby?
Well, it is a risk, and you sort of think, yes, maybe he is being appointed on the back of his name. But then is it any more of a risk than appointing a manager who's only ever coached a reserve team? You know, Watford have appointed the chap from Chelsea, Brendan Rodgers, who never coached first team football before. There's loads of examples of former managers former players going straight into jobs with no managerial experience at all.
He can't possibly do any worse than Paul Jewell did. Paul Jewell's tenure in charge of Derby was an embarrassment on and off the field. I mean, they were an absolute disgrace. And so, you know,
off the field.
Oh, well, he was the subject of a tabloid sting for something he did on camera a few years ago. So, you know, that probably it's not ideal, is it?
No, he wrote and directed and performed it. Yeah, interesting. Okay, well, there you go. Best of luck to all concerned. The other semi-final, Spurs trashed Burnley. What was it? 4-1.
4-1 in the end,
nil down at the interval Tuesday night.
Well, does this show that Harry Redknapp's a much better man manager than Alex Ferguson? Both Premier League sides down 1-0 at half time to Championship sides. Tottenham come back and win 4-1, and Man United stay the same.
I think Tottenham had a slightly stronger lineup out than Man United. That's probably a bit of a stretching argument, but.
Interestingly enough, they started out with more first-teamers out there, and it was actually bringing on the reserve Jamie O'Hara that made the difference, or so I read in the paper, not having seen the game myself.
I think the other sideline to that story was obviously Jermaine Defoe being welcomed back to White Hart Lane. And I thought it was an amazing story this morning that said that Tottenham had to pay Jermaine Defoe's loyalty bonus for that he was due to stay at Portsmouth. It was all very confusing.
He was there how long? 7 months? No.
Well, they already had
a little under a year, I think.
They ostensibly paid Portsmouth, £7 million to take him on loan for a few months. And now they're having to shell out a loyalty bonus. Jermaine Defoe decided to turn up at White Hart Lane dressed as a Dickensian chimney sweep.
Well, yeah, I saw
reasons
that his mum,
best known to himself.
Well, there's this controversy over his mum's involvement. I thought that was for the hat and scarf combo that she sent him out in.
And gloves on a piece of string hanging out of his sleeves.
But it turns out that they've been a bit premature with his unveiling on Tuesday because the deal is not yet finalised and there is even a legal wrangle, which we always love to discuss. Barry, well, you've read up on this.
We do love a good legal wrangle. The paperwork hasn't been cleared by the Premier League or the FA yet, so he may not be able to play for Spurs at the weekend. Basically, Defoe, before moving from Spurs to Pompey, dropped his agent, Sky Andrew, and took on other representation. Andrew is suing him because of this, which means because the case is still under arbitration by a three-man panel, that he's not allowed to take on another agent. So his mother helped him negotiate his move back to Spurs. It is allowed for close relatives to help you negotiate a transfer, but they have to be registered, and she isn't. So now Sky Andrew is... he could have further grounds for a complaint. Personally, I think your mum should be allowed to help you do anything in life because she's your mum and it's her job. But Sky Andrew and the FAC.
It's a telling legal argument that was, yes. Though, yeah.
But isn't it all a load of nonsense about nothing? Because when you look at the reality of it, which is that Jermaine Defoe was employed by Tottenham for a number of years. Mm. Jermaine Defoe worked under Harry Redknapp for a little bit of time and therefore knew each other quite well. You can imagine that all it needs to happen is that Harry and Jermaine sit down over a mug of tea at the training ground and they say, well, how's about 80 grand a week, Jermaine? And he says, yeah, all right, boss, and it's done. I mean,
the nitty-gritty of some contract negotiation seems to be, you know, like, say, Paul Scholes famously just goes in, I think, with his dad or his lawyer or someone, has a read of his contract and signs it. You know, it takes half an hour. And other players have these protracted negotiations.
David Beckham, for example, with the bizarre... and Galliani, famously, after the deal was finally done, he said, I'd like to thank... David Beckham and his wife and his team of lawyers who are along for this adventure.
But it's a bit of a breakthrough, isn't it? Because we often hear of dads and brothers and cousins and uncles getting involved.
All power to Mrs. Defoe.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Excellent. That's a fresh viewpoint on that. Thanks, John. Other transfer news. Listen, there are two here that are kind of generally regarded as givens, and it's only a matter of time before it happens. I just wonder if they are actually going to go through in the end. One is that man Tevez. Who has now been rude about Sir Alex and ergo must be departing soon, but I'm just wondering who's going to actually stump up the cash for him. The other one is Rocky Santa Cruz, who was St. Pauli St. Kilda points out, is a 27-year-old who's only ever scored more than 5 goals in one season in his career. So far this season, he's averaging a goal every 6 hours. And I think we said, the price tag being talked about is 18 million plus Tal Ben Haim. I think we said on Monday that it's possibly a season too late for this.
Well, he had a great season last season, didn't he, old Rocky? And he's been poor. Well, I say poor.
And before that, he never really did anything.
Well, he was at Bayern Munich. I mean, that's not a tiny club, is it?
So, no, but he wasn't scoring any goals for them. I think he got 3 goals. I might be completely wrong. I might be making this up. I think he got 3 goals the season before that.
But he's been around. He's an international player. He had a great season last season. The thing that surprises me about the transfer is that Mark Hughes and Manchester City, who've had a £12 million plus bid refused by Blackburn this morning, are after a striker at all. And they've got this shambolic defence that clearly needs a lot of work. And they're after, you know, spending £12 million on a striker.
Well, they just brought in Wayne Bridge. And apparently they've made an offer for Shay Given.
That's another Given.
Yeah.
There's 3 Givens.
it's a fair point you make again.
I think it is, yeah.
But do you think Tevez is going to go through then? Do you think that's going to happen, Amy?
Well, I think you were quite right by saying who is going to buy him. I mean, in the current market, 32 million is more than 32 million was a year ago. It's an absolute fortune. And I think you've got to be utterly, utterly brilliant to command anywhere near that kind of money.
He is pretty special.
But is he utterly, utterly brilliant?
I think the other thing is that Sir Alex, given that his team can't score for Toffee at the moment, is probably quite eager to hang on to him, is he not?
Yeah, but you've got to look at how often under the Glazers regime, Manchester United are willing to spend 30 million plus on a player. Now, they did it last summer with Berbatov. In their squad, they've got quite a number of £30 million players compared to a lot of major clubs when you consider Rooney, obviously, Ferdinand as well, came in for that kind of fee, albeit in different times. So I just don't know whether there is that bottomless pit. I think that he's in a position where if he wants to spend big money on a player, it will be made available. But obviously, he's not going to do that willy-nilly.
Mm. And in much the same way as Defoe has come to resemble a Dickensian chimney sweep, Tevez now increasingly looks like an old peasant woman who might, offer to sell you lucky heather. And would you pay 32 million for that?
It depends how lucky the heather is, I suppose.
I suppose it does, yeah. Football Week Extra for
Guardian.co.uk. Now, other transfer news. Whizzing briefly through this, I read that Portsmouth are looking to bring Edu and Joey Barton into their midfield, which would certainly enliven things there on the south coast.
The Joey Barton to Portsmouth rumour is interesting. I just can't help but feel that Tony Adams thinks he, sees fellow damaged goods and thinks he can change him.
Well, Tony Adams is a big believer in the power of his own words. I mean, before Jermaine Defoe up sticks, it was, if Jermaine needs convincing, I'll convince him, was Tony's line on the weekend. Yeah. And, he patently wouldn't.
Maybe he's convinced him to leave.
Perhaps so.
I've said before, I'm sort of not a fan of Joey Barton, but I can see good in him, like Luke Skywalker and Darth Vader. I don't think he's a completely lost cause, and he is a good player.
One for your metaphor.
So you're saying that Joey Barton is your father?
No, no, I'm not.
That's a shame.
Jermaine Pennant, Amy, who we read has been offered a pre-contract because he'll be out of contract with Liverpool at the end of this season, I'm guessing. And Milan have said, that's fine, stick around at Anfield and we'll pick you up for free for a fat contract in return. And everybody's going, well, why on earth do Milan want Jermaine Pennant? But it doesn't make... it seems pretty clear to me. They pick him up on a free, yeah, they have to pay his wages. And I think he's there's potentially a hugely gifted player there. He's no?
Well, you
he's
say
only,
that.
What, 26 or something?
He's almost 26, I think, next week or so. But he has had a lot of chances to make something of his career. And so far, he hasn't quite had the wherewithal to grasp that opportunity. I just think there are certain players that look great at 16 and you give them lots and lots of different chances to mature into the player you think they're going to be, and they don't take any of them. And it's been nearly 10 years he's been involved in professional football. You'd have expected him to do it by now if he was going to, so therefore it surprises me that a club of Milan's stature are interested in someone who, okay, it might just be a salary that might not be hugely expensive in terms of their finances, but I still can't really see that Milan are going to make it happen when it didn't happen at Arsenal under Arsene Wenger, right, who's pretty good at nurturing young players, and it didn't happen under Rafa Benitez with Liverpool.
Well, Milan, as the club that just signed David Beckham, are known for their conservative transfer policy.
But so, on the other hand, I mean, you look at David Beckham going to Milan and you think, well, if you look at how Milan play, well, where's he actually going to play in the system? Even Beckham.
Yeah.
They don't really play with wingers.
No.
So by the same token, why are they signing Pennant? Unless they're suddenly going to change their formation, but I
maybe
they
feel it'd be nice to have the
will.
Option. Because it is interesting how many times they do, you know, traditionally the thing about Milan is if you get to Pirlo, you shut them down. And they've not really, over the last 3-4 years, been able to overcome that issue. They do end up often very fragmented because of that fact that people know that they're going to play through the middle. They play very narrow. And maybe Ancelotti would actually like the option of actually having somebody out wide who, you know, delivering crosses and that. I don't know, but it is true that he put in an absolutely sterling performance, I think it's fair to say, in the 2007 Champions League final against Milan for Liverpool. And it's just about possible that what a player like Jermaine needs is to be completely removed from an environment in which he is basically stewed in his own juices and put in a completely new context away from all the usual temptations or the usual kind of mental habits, etc., etc., and given a 100% fresh start. I might be being romantic about this transfer, but I was quite interested by
it. I think that's a lovely idea, but the other side of that coin is that possibly Jermaine Pennant might be a bit of an Ian Rush, who of course famously turned up in Italy and said the problem is that they all speak Italian. And you know,
he wasn't wrong.
Whether he's the kind of individual, the kind of man that can cope with being in a foreign country on his own with a different language, I think that would be an enormous challenge for him.
Oh well, you can get all the news on the website guardian.co.uk/football. So all the latest transfer news, of course, on Guardian Unlimited, where you can also visit us to post on the Football Weekly page, or you can always do that equally on our Facebook page. Let's hear from Sid Lowe and see if Dr. Sid can bring a smile back to our faces.
Hello.
Ah! Now, Sid, of course, you know all about referees being handy with the old red card, do you not? El Galactico says, I'm surprised Sid did not mention the lower league game in Spain between Recreativo Linense and Saladillo, in which 19 players were sent off during a second-half brawl. That must be some kind of record, Sid.
Well, it is a record, as we've discovered, but It's a rule that I'm very, very, very dubious about. As much as anything else, I'm dubious about it because, well, basically, the referee, what happened was that there was a fight. Some people ran on the pitch. I think there was a fight between two players. Some people ran on the pitch, and there'd already been a red card before. This is about 10 minutes into the second half. Some fans ran on the pitch. It turned into a little bit of a fight. Or it appears to have been a bit of a fight, as I say, with some fans on the pitch. Sounds like a fairly major fight. Well, the referee ran into the dressing room. And in the dressing room, he basically said the game is over. And according to his official match report that he has to put through to the Federation, he says it's over because I sent off 9 players from each team plus, of course, the already sent-off player. So, in other words, 19 in total. Now, of course, it's not the same as him actually standing on the pitch and waving a red card at all of these players. He's decided this in the dressing room, having not actually got the card out. And what's happened is that since then, both clubs have come out together and said they don't understand what the referee was talking about. How can it have been a 19-man brawl when, at the end of the game, both sets of players pretty much walked off together chatting about what a lunatic the referee was? And both sets of fans have, you know, have sort of fans, I mean, obviously we're talking Reckonau games, so we're talking probably 200 fans at most, have kind of said that there wasn't very much going on. It certainly, it strikes me as this is the kind of record that ultimately probably Norris McWhirter would turn up and say this one isn't going in the Guinness Book of Records.
On the course of my extensive research for today's pod, chanced across Leo Messi's Team of the Year. And it has three Barca players, two ex-Barca, two Argentina players, no Cristiano Ronaldo and no Real Madrid players at all. Have you seen it?
I must say I haven't seen this, so perhaps you could what his Team of the Year is.
Czech, my son, Rio Ferdinand, Carlos Puyol, Gio van Bronckhorst, Zanetti, Xavi, Fabregas, Iniesta, Aguero and Mr. Wayne Rooney.
That is quite interesting, isn't it? I think one of the things you have to remember about Leo Messi, and this may be ever so slightly exaggerating it, but I'll kind of explain it in a second. Leo Messi doesn't know anything about football. and as I say, that is ever so slightly exaggerating, but let me explain what I mean by that. Messi is a guy who is basically incredibly talented, as we all know. He's quite probably the best player in the world at the moment, and I think will go on to be one of the best of all time if he carries on like this. But he's a guy that doesn't actually show very much interest in football, so much so that up to a point, I mean, obviously some weeks I'm sure it's different, and I'm for sure that because of the media attention it means that he does sometimes know, but there have been times where I've been reliably informed that on a Tuesday or something, you'll say something to Messi about who he's playing that weekend, and he won't know. He won't know who he's playing against. He just doesn't care. It's not part of his makeup to be watching other games, to be taking an interest in other teams. So I think one of the things that suggests, and obviously we don't know this for sure, is that Messi's team will be based on quite an impressionistic interpretation from him on the players he's played against, which actually in a way is quite nice. You know, these are the people he's noticed and the people he's noticed when he's been playing against, rather than the fact that he's watching loads of games, as, for example, someone like Jamie Carragher would do. So I think in that sense, we you know, while Leo Messi is obviously an authority on it in one sense, he's not an authority on it in another.
All right then, Sid, listen, what games won't Leo Messi be watching this weekend?
Well, I think there's a really quite an interesting one, actually, which is not often you'd say this about these two teams. The Deportivo against Sevilla. Now, it probably won't be very attacking and it probably won't be very exciting, but these two teams are now, Deportivo are in a European place, which is a minor miracle. Sevilla are still doing rather well, but playing really poor football and everyone's on the back of their coach. And not only that, because this weekend is a league game, they played them in a cup this midweek and they're playing them in a cup again next week. So it'll be three games between the two sides in 8 days.
Excellent. The transfer rumours, we read stories. Danielson, ex of Deportivo, is it Bolton or Wigan?
Bolton.
Bolton, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, you've probably seen him in action more recently than we have. Any chance that one's going to turn out to be a bit of a gem of a signing?
No, I don't think so. I think it could well be a gem of a signing in that every now and again he might do something that fans go, oh, that was a bit good, wasn't it? But really and truly, Danielson has been, I mean, this may be a little harsh to say this, but a complete and utter joke in Spanish football. He came, obviously, as the most expensive player in the world at the time to Betis. He did step over after step over after step over and never went anywhere. And really and truly, he really achieved very, very, very little in Spain. And it's a real shame because, you know, the 98 World Cup, he looked like a really genuinely talented player, and there had been occasional flashes at Betis. But the truth is that his career in Spain has become a byword for wasting time and just for really not being worth it and doing pointless tricks that don't take you anywhere. So much so that it's genuinely become a byword for it that Robinho, for example, and here perhaps is the key, Robinho came to Real Madrid as the new Pelé. When he left, a lot of his harshest critics said that he departed as the new Danielson. In other words, a guy who does a few fancy flicks but never actually does anything. For what it's worth, I think that's extremely harsh on Robinho, who actually had a much more important role for Real Madrid than that suggests.
Thanks, Sid, for all of that. And look forward to speaking to you on Monday.
Nice one. Speak to you then. Cheers.
Cheers, Sid. Okay. Well,
one thing about Sid stuff there.
Hello, John.
Could be a quiz question. What's the similarity between David Batty and Leo Messi? Footballers who don't like football.
Interesting. Yeah. Just David Batty not.
But I think David Batty genuinely didn't like football.
I think he retired and said he never wanted to see a football again and that sort of thing.
What is David Batty at these days, by the way?
Nothing to do with football. He hates it, you see.
If anyone knows, could they please post it on the blog?
I bet the irony is he's probably, I don't know, manufacturing footballs or working in a production line with footballs.
Could be, yeah.
Yeah, that's one for listeners. It certainly helped us out with a bit of info we asked for on Monday, so we'll see if they can come up with the goods on that one. Meantime, Serie A swings back into action this weekend. No question about what the big game is. Roma hosting Milan at the Stadio Olimpico. Roma, who were defeated 3-2 down in Catania just before Christmas, which kind of put the brakes on their recent impressive comeback. They're now in 11th place. They do have a game in hand. They're trying to reach 4th place, which is kind of the minimum they'd expect from the season. They don't have Francesco Totti, who's out. He should be back, though, by the time they play Arsenal in the Champions League in February. They are taking on a Milan side that apparently will have David Beckham at least on the bench, despite the fact that he hasn't played a competitive match in, apart from that 45 minutes in the friendly, but a proper match he hasn't played in, what, two months, would it be?
Since he left Real Madrid, some would say.
Indeed. There you go. Rossoneri in some fine form, although they're still 9 points off the top of the table, and they've had defeats against Juventus, Palermo, that kind of thing. Nesta also is back. Says that he will be fit to play in a couple of weeks, which is a huge surprise, because the last thing we'd heard was that he was heading towards a kind of one of those kind of gradual vanishing from the scene type departures in the manner of, say, Van Basten, who, you know, just went from one operation to another and then just quietly slipped away. Now, Nesta had been off in Miami with a bad back, and he came back, and apparently the problem wasn't solved, but now he says he's fit again, which will make a huge difference to them.
You think anyone can realistically catch Juve?
Inter, sorry.
Are Juve the only team that can realistically catch them? They're 6 points clear.
Yeah, the probability is no one's going to catch Inter, because on the occasions that they've come face-to-face with their rivals, Inter have actually done a good job of keeping them all at bay. The only hope is that this time last season we were looking at a very, very similar position. Inter, I think, were maybe even 1 point further ahead of Roma last season. There were fewer teams in a position to challenge them because Juve weren't back to full strength.
To be honest, I only asked you out of politeness. Right. I don't really care.
But, Barry, the thing is that it came down to the final day of the season. After them being 7, or I think possibly even more points clear, it came down to the final day of the season. Roma were actually going to be they were virtual champions for much of that final day of the season, until Zlatan Ibrahimovic came on. He was a bit injured in Inter's game against Parma, scored 2 second half goals and wrestled the title out of the Giallorossi's grip. I should just say, actually, Beckham did play that 45 minutes against Hamburg, and people thought that, you know, it was nothing special, but, you know, he just got the job done. He has apparently been doing all sorts of extraordinary things in training with Ronaldinho, and the pair have a special understanding. But the player who really impressed against Hamburg was Flamini, who started. There you go.
Football Weekly Extra with James Richardson.
Okay, posts. And part three. The fly in the ointment says, I know I sound pedantic, but that gag last Monday about Zola and Les Miserables doesn't really hold up scrutiny, as everyone knows Victor Hugo wrote Les Miserables, and I can't think of any character called Zola in all of its 1,200 pages. Fair point. Zola, of course, wrote Terminal, which is in no way relevant to West Ham's situation. My mistake. Aussie with footballs. Serbian signings, Zoran Tosic and Adem Ljajic. That's how you pronounce it, guys. Thank you, Aussie with Footballs. He wrote in with the info. Adem Ljajic has been given the tag Little Kaká. He's been an excellent player for Serbia at youth level and has broken into the Partizan first team squad at 16. He'll stay at Partizan until he's 18. Zoran Tosic, meanwhile, is a player who is reasonably versatile, very, very fast, apparently. There's a little bit of concern in Serbia that he's going to be too lightweight for the Premier League, but he is very good at free kicks in the manner of, say, Mihailovic, says Aussie with Footballs, who was supplying this information because we were a bit perplexed as to why Sir Alex Ferguson had gone and spunked, as I believe the expression is, up to 17 million on these two Serbian unknowns. But unknown they are no longer. Blue Moon 99 says, your best of the year show was a bit rubbish, like you were doing an exam you hadn't studied for. Eerie how he knows that. You could collect the best, but the producer Pete wasn't here for our best of show. Perhaps we ought to do a best of show this week or next week.
Best of season.
We'll do a best of season. Yeah, well, we could do it next week, and you could collect all the bits up between now. No, okay. End of season, Blue Moon. Andy G, 1966. James, are we going to get a preview on Thursday of this weekend's biggest game? AIR United against Kilmarnock in the Scottish Cup. Only their fifth meetings in 15 years, as Kilmarnock in that time have always been at least one league higher than AIR, but in those four previous meetings were swiftly dispatched with not a goal to show for their efforts. Barry?
What?
Do you want to share?
What is AIR?
Oh, no, we're not going to have a preview.
No, we're not.
No? Okay. All right, then. Oh, I'm sorry about that. And there you go. We must press on, because there's the Premier League weekend to discuss now, eh? Where
it's going to seem a bit flat. What? Now that we know AIR against Kilmarnock,
that's not a particularly outstanding stat, is it? Five times in 15 years. That's just quite often, but not that often.
I think the key thing was the fact that Kilmarnock were always higher, but AIR still always beat them.
Oh, I see.
It's really not.
Didn't really take it all in.
No. Right, Premier League weekend. Can I interest you perhaps in Man United Chelsea? If I read the papers and watch, you know, your media, your broadcast media, I come away with the impression that Chelsea have a great away record, but are busy unravelling faster than, you know,
The broadcast media of which you are an integral part?
Yeah.
And yeah, every time I look at my television, you're on it.
Bless you, Barry.
Part of it. I didn't say that was good.
Oh, okay.
But just an observation.
My question is, you know, they are second after all, and humming along happily in the Champions League. Is this all just press invention? Are they really falling to pieces, Amy Lawrence?
I don't know about falling to pieces, but I mean, they're definitely not quite what we would expect Chelsea to be in this current regime. And it's probably not the Chelsea that Chelsea fans have come to expect. And I know one of my pals who's a Chelsea fan actually sort of rather pessimistically was saying, well, if things don't turn around soon and others don't start performing with a little bit of the enthusiasm of Frank Lampard, we'll end up in the fourth place fight with Aston Villa and Arsenal, which I think actually is probably rather extreme and sort of the natural doom and gloom that you have when you're talking about your own team. But I just think there are too many Chelsea players who are below the level that you would expect them to be, and Lampard is the honourable exception to this.
Right. How damaging will it be if they lose this game?
Both Man United and Chelsea have done averagely in games against the top four so far, or perhaps even a bit less than averagely.
Chelsea have won none of their last three big four clashes, while United have won none of their last four. So yeah.
Well, there you go. Yeah. So, I think you can still win the league and not do terribly well against the top four. So,
Well, I think we had a knowledge on that whereby the matches against the big four, between the big four teams, quite closely correlated the actual eventual table in the big four.
There you go.
Arsenal, for example, are extremely good against the big four, but struggling
to even
get into
the league. Doesn't really necessarily make total sense.
Right. Also, Manchester United score on average fewer points against Chelsea than any other Premiership side. So 1.28 per game.
Right. Chelsea have won more times and taken more points from Man United at Old Trafford than any other team, is a correlatory fact. Also of significance is the fact that United, though absolutely brilliant at home, and in fact the last time they dropped points at home in the league was against Newcastle, bizarrely, on the opening day, cannot score goals at the moment. Bizarrely, given the lineup of talent that they have. They've had, I think, four goals in the last six matches.
Maybe the big winners this weekend could be Liverpool, who will be keeping their fingers crossed for a draw.
Right, and they will be at Stoke, of course, so they'll have their own,
game.
Game, yeah, indeed so. They drew with Stoke at Anfield, although there was a disallowed goal and some controversy.
Although Stoke have come off the boil a little since then, haven't they? And they're not quite the throwing
force they were. Right. Well, so basically, nobody's holding out any great... Nobody sounds actually terribly excited about this match, which is...
I'm not excited about it. I mean, there are three far more important games, I think, at the bottom end of the Premier League. Middlesbrough are playing Sunderland, Newcastle are playing West Ham, Portsmouth are playing Man City. I think the results of those games could go a long way towards sorting out who goes down and who stays up.
Mm. All right, well, which one grabs your attention first of all?
Well, I think if somebody loses the Portsmouth-Man City game, they're in serious, serious trouble. You know, I think you can then say they are officially in free fall, and that's a huge, huge game. Middlesbrough-Sunderland, obviously, is a derby of sorts. And I personally think there's a good team hiding somewhere in the Riverside Stadium, but it doesn't show itself very often.
Right.
And I hope they don't show themselves on the Saturday.
Downing's still there at the moment. Sunderland have been in some trouble since, as you know, Ricky Spragia got confirmed. Just going back to that Portsmouth-Man City game. City, they do have the incredible bipolar form. They will suddenly turn it on. And you might think that a Portsmouth side who failed to get past Bristol City in the Cup the other day are an ideal opportunity for them to do so. Is that the kind of game, do you think, where Man City are going to step up to the plate?
Well, I'm going down to Fratton Park on Saturday for the game, which I haven't done any research for it yet, so I can't offer any great insight. But having seen Portsmouth a couple of times this season, the importance of Diarra and Defoe to that entire team is huge. And to lose whatever £45 million worth of talent over the last fortnight is a really, really big blow. So it's hard to who do you pair Peter Crouch with when you've lost the little fella. You've got Kanu, Nugent, who's not quite done it. And so it's you sort of take Defoe and Diarra out of the team, and it suddenly does look a little bit shaky. And I can see City going down there. It's the archetypal difficult place to go, but I can see City going down there and getting a win.
Yeah, maybe especially now that he's weeded out the rebels from his squad, Mark Hughes.
Yeah, but he's still got to sort out what's going on at the back, because it's all very well. You can see a lot of goals in that game. Again, it'll probably be 0-0, but I just think that Portsmouth might struggle to find a partner for Peter Crouch, but if they give him enough of the ball high up enough in the air, then he may well get some good fortune from that.
Mm. Interesting. And Newcastle, meanwhile, will be hosting West Ham. Newcastle have Obafemi Martins, who's now out for... How long is he out for with his hernia operation?
I haven't a clue.
A while, anyway. He won't be playing
six
in that game.
6 weeks, at least, I'd say.
Right, okay. And West Ham have put a decent run together, have they not, recently in the Premier League? But they have the spectre of mass departures hanging over them. What do you think?
Well, it's Kieran Dyer returning to Newcastle is quite interesting as well, isn't it?
Mm.
I can't see West Ham going there and winning. Mm. But, who's going to score Newcastle's goals?
Indeed so.
I see that Newcastle have been linked as well with Barry Ferguson, which really arched an eyebrow at that. I mean, I don't know if he's ever going to recover from his ankle problem. He seems to be unfit. He's already had one shocking spell with Blackburn where he just didn't cut it all. Admittedly, he was blighted by injuries while there, so it's unfair to say it's just another SPL star coming down and not being able to hack it in the Premier League. But to see Newcastle being linked with someone like him, just, I don't know, I can't see things getting any better for them anytime soon.
Not a very auspicious rumour, that one. Just 5 points separating the bottom 10 clubs. Arsenal, meanwhile, are taking on Bolton, Amy.
Well, probably a different kind of game than the archetypal Arsenal-Bolton game of yore, which was always something where Arsenal were a bit afraid to play Bolton. But I think Bolton are slightly less intimidating now and play a more open game, which, if anything, might suit Arsenal. But you just... and while they continue to be so up and down, it's difficult to see where Arsenal are going to really get the kind of consistency needed to take on Villa, who, apart from anything else, have got such a fantastic run of good fortune going for them at the moment. I mean, every time you seem to watch them, I think it's a great credit to Martin O'Neill and the way that he actually puts a team out, which is they're going to play at full pelt for the entire duration of the game. They're going to never give up. They're going to chase everything. And it's a credit to the way he approaches the game that Villa have actually been quite lucky this
season. Well, there were a lot of refereeing decisions going their way of late against Hull last weekend.
Yeah, but it was the right decision.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, good.
Still, so you still sometimes have to be fortunate to get the right decision, don't you? I
mean, you make your own luck in this game, don't you? Wigan taking on Tottenham. Wigan, you know, the form team in the Premier League with 5 wins in 6 games, but don't worry, we're not going to discuss that. Everton taking on Hull. Fulham, Blackburn, and Stoke Liverpool as previously advertised. That is it for another rip-roaring edition of Football Weekly Extra. We're back on Monday with the shadow of a programme that is Football Weekly. And in the meantime, many, many thanks, John Ashdown.
Thank you.
Amy Lawrence.
Thank you.
Producer Pete. And Barry Glendening.
Thanks.
And you, listener, thanks. We'll be back on Monday. See you then.